Greetings, everyone. You're with Norm Schultz, Choma Ren, and I'm Nick Urkus. This is the Mile High Sanity Project, and you're in it. Welcome to the return of the Mile High Sanity Project Returns. I am one of your hosts, Nicholas Urkus. We're here to talk about cosmos. It's just what we do. We talk about cosmos.
Well, it's where we live.
The Mile High Cosmos Project, Episode 7, The Clean Room. Or the fucking awesome room, because this was a great episode. I hope everyone enjoyed it. We loved it. I said before, for you Zeppelin fans, get the lead out. That's what this whole thing is about. Yep. I'm here with Norman Schultz.
Good morning.
And I'm here with Choma Ren.
Hello.
I feel like we've been here before.
We had to do a little bit of editing. But, you know, before we get too far afield, I want to make sure that I say that this is, I think, my favorite episode so far.
Easily my favorite episode. I thought it was just amazing.
It's a great story. A great story about science. Great story about what it has to face. The forces that work against it and how eventually it can succeed. And
right.
One man patiently working. And it's just great.
Well, and the whole episode is based around what came out of a simple question. What is the true age of the Earth?
Right. An inflammatory question on its own.
Yeah.
And then how that led to other things.
It seemingly, it sounds almost innocuous. Innocuous, I can't say that word. It sounds not innocuous. Like a, it sounds like a pretty straightforward question. Just what is the age of the Earth? But it's interesting what kind of forces would take offense to that question and the kind of answers that you would be seeking, the kind of implications.
Well, and yeah, I mean, you kind of expect that, but science can work independently of that. But then this episode gets into forces that science can't really work independently of, i.e. funding.
We're talking, of course, about the Illuminati.
Well, you know, I mean, scientists, when they work, they have to get paid. They have to pay, you know, for their tests and pay for equipment. It can get quite expensive rapidly, right?
Right.
And well, so you... Got to get. Oh, Chalmer, go ahead.
What's interesting to me is we often talk about conflicts with science and religion with questions like how old is the Earth? But in this one, it's completely corporate vested interest.
Right.
It wasn't a religious issue. It wasn't a cultural issue. It was entirely money. It was economic.
That's why Atlas shrugged.
Crap. Yeah.
Oh no! Well, maybe
everyone
we'll get some
and
more
everyone fun. Dropped 10 IQ points. Atlas shrugged a little too hard.
No, and the other thing I really like about the episode is it's self-critical of science. This is, I think, the first episode of Cosmos that they show how science can be abused.
It's one of the first shows in general I can remember doing that, actually.
Oh, well, we don't watch religious stations.
No, but I mean, you know, well, you expect it, though, from some kind of show that's doing some kind of crap like, you know, the moon landing is fake. You expect it from this, but this is like
as in anything on the History Channel?
Right, basically. Well, no, those are all the aliens built the pyramids.
the occult magic of Hitler.
Right. That's different. Chalmer, once again, the hero of this science episode gets to be a chemist, so you must be pretty happy, and takes us back to 1966 geochemist Claire Patterson. Pat. Right. You know?
Yeah, I was very happy about it. He did some interesting work.
Right. It opens up with him walking as a sad old man down the street, afraid of some kind of phantom menace.
Yeah, it was a great... I'm totally on board with the animation. You guys remember how the first episode I was unsure about the animation, maybe even into the second episode. Now, I love the animation. It's such a great way to illustrate these ideas and show some variety in the visuals. It's just great. They're doing a great job with it.
The contrast with the actual visuals of space are fantastic.
Yeah.
I love it. And one of the things they did, I saw Seth MacFarlane talking about the way the animation director took it, where they wanted to use some photorealistic backgrounds that they would kind of paint onto. So that's why some of the backgrounds look like real life. It is actually still life that is animated,
right,
and stuff. And I think it lets you blend it really well. But you know, the idea of seeing Pat walk down the street and how he's like looking at these like phantom things appearing on people, you would have a hard time illustrating that.
Yeah, and it, you know, I like that it gives a little bit of hint of what they're talking about by showing that stuff coming out of the tailpipe of a car that goes by,
right?
And it's like a classic, you know, '60s. Car with the fins, and it's great.
Yeah, it's light. See, how would you film that? You would have to film like you used to go to the set of Mad Men. Like, can we borrow your set? Because
yeah.
Well, and you know who voiced Claire Patterson?
No, but I did recognize the voice, at least. I didn't know who it was, but it sounded familiar.
Yeah, I thought Richard so, Gere. Too.
Richard Gere?
Richard Gere.
Huh.
Awesome.
That's cool.
Huh. I like Richard Gere.
Yeah, me too.
He's just so handsome. Oh, my gosh.
I like him better now.
Right. Well, I think they're finding that there's a lot of support out there from celebrity because people like the project. So I imagine that makes it easier for them to get.
Well, the original Cosmos was so classic, and I imagine even the people who missed it or will still recognize at this point how important it was. I mean, it has that kind of cult following, that kind of like mainstream penetration, I guess, you know, also that kind of...
Well, now we're getting dirty.
I just wanted to say penetrate. I'm sorry. I just wanted to.
This is a family show.
That's true. Fuck. Sorry. Ignore all that. Chalmer, Lead, is that PB on the elemental chart?
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
All right. You want to avoid that stuff.
Well, you don't really need to unless somebody pumps it into the atmosphere.
Yeah, in large form, you can handle it to some degree, correct?
Yeah.
It's the particulate form where you are breathing it and getting into your system. Its toxicity is similar to that of radioactivity, right?
No, it's not radioactive.
I'm not saying it's radioactive. I'm saying the way it gets into the body and causes harm is similar to radioactivity. Is that not right?
Not really.
No?
Well, they talked about what it does to you. I mean, the way it like can block neurotransmitters in the brain,
right,
and things. In a way, they said it mimics other.
You have a lot of things called cofactors in your body.
Right. I guess what I mean is that it's much more dangerous when you inhale or ingest it, not when you just touch it to your skin. That's what I mean.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay,
and it's also kind of the whole point of the episode. There's not actually a lot of lead at the surface. You could go most of your life without encountering very much lead.
Yeah. Well, if you were living in nature.
Right.
We use lead in a lot of things. So.
You were living in 1850.
But the state of nature is bad.
Well, lead-wise, it's good.
Right.
You got to watch out for everybody else, but other than that.
You know, the idea of how old is the Earth, obviously it's a question that a lot of people must have been pondering throughout the ages, and I liked that they went back to 1650, to Archbishop James Usher of Ireland, and he was one of the first people to really try and calculate the age of the Earth. And even though he based it on religion, given what they knew about stuff back then, I think it's in some ways kind of an admirable attempt to try it. Because he looked inside the Bible and was like, how can I establish a date?
It's not that hard.
Right.
Yeah.
And you're just counting the begats.
Right.
You know, the begats.
You just do the addition.
But he did look for
a date that you can correlate to other things, which he did it. And this is, people in theology, and they know about biblical dating.
Right. Nebuchadnezzar is what he used.
Babylonian Empire. That's something that's the existence of them and the existence of Nebuchadnezzar is corroborated by outside non-biblical sources.
That's not just the boat from 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. No. Okay.
No.
Or the Matrix, Morpheus.
I'm ignoring you.
Fine. He said that I didn't realize that he had such a specific date that the Earth began. So it said the Earth began. Neil says the Earth began on October 22nd and 4004 BC at 6 p.m. on Saturday.
Right.
That's pretty fucking specific.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That I was kind of like, really?
Yeah.
So that would make the seventh day a Friday. Who rests on a Friday?
Everybody.
Oh. I work my ass off on Friday.
But look, I know it's a little bit of an aside, but I have to kind of throw down the gauntlet on this because the Bible is committed to this age. The Bible is a book that states flatly in non-symbolic language, in very literal language. I mean, if you wanted to write something and you wanted it to be taken metaphorically, then you would write in ways that are creative and et cetera, comparative. And this doesn't write like that at all. It is the closest example of how to write literally by saying a person's name, how old they were when they gave birth to their son, and then continuing that.
That's not a metaphor.
That is not metaphorical. That is as literal as you could possibly write. And when you look at that, it really does commit the Bible to suggesting that at least human beings, if not the earth, are 6,000 years old. And so what I'm always baffled by is people who are members of liberal Christian churches who do not believe, you know, they accept evolution, don't believe that the earth, they're not young earth creationists. I think, well, that's, I guess, good in a way, but how do you make sense of the Bible? Because now the Bible has a flat-out error.
Because human beings are pretty comfortable living with contradictions, I think.
Well, yeah, but it just, it really...
It bothers me.
It frustrates me that right. people can twist things and move the goalposts.
I just think that that's a good way. I mean, they're having it both ways.
Right.
So when it needs to function as simply a metaphor, well, then a day to God is an eon to us.
I hate that one.
Right. That bothers me so much. It's cheating.
What's a day to God? A day. That's why he said day.
Right. Well, and with this, we're not even talking about days from the perspective of God. You know, if you're looking at Genesis and he talks about a creative day, I could even see that being a metaphor. I don't really think that it is the way it's written, but I could see the debate. When you're talking about the age of a person and how old they were when they had their child, that's not a day or a year or a metaphor. That's a literal year.
Norm, God meant the way we say, like, back in the day. That's how he was saying it. He's like, back in the day.
Right. So, you know, it just – and I think it's really a simple syllogism to me. If the Bible – a book that contains errors can't be written by an all-knowing being. The Bible contains errors, so it wasn't written by an all-knowing being. It's really that simple. In which case, why would you listen to it any more than any other book?
I don't like when people try and do, like, the answers in Genesis thing or any kind of – again, the way they move the goalposts is sometimes they want it to be a literal book that is historical – and can be relied upon. And sometimes whenever you point out something ridiculous or that's insane from like, they're like, well, that's the Old Testament.
I gotta chime in on this. Everybody listening to us, I want you to, if you're in front of a computer, I want you to try something right now. I want you to type in Google or in the top of your browser, which hopefully will use Google, but you try to use Google. It'll probably work with other search engines, but just type in age of the earth. When I do that, the second website is from creation.com.
Yep.
When I've typed in other things for Cosmos, very often the second or even the first site that comes up is a religious website contradicting it. And that is because you're browsing in this country. It detects your IP and customizes your search. If you did this in like France or another country, those sites would not come up that high.
Really?
It's doing it because we're in a country where in this country more people are putting those kinds of connections, and therefore Google is picking up on it. And that I think is a testament to just how messed up this country is on this issue.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's divisive. You know, and
it's really frustrating, and that's why I want to keep chiming in on this. That if you're a science minded person, you really can't just sit back idle. There really is an argument to be won.
I think so too. This is why I don't criticize. I know that Bill Nye got a lot of flack whenever he debated, you know, Ken Ham, and I understand what people are saying. Like, you're giving credence to their argument. I don't think you are. I think you're exposing it, because most of the articles I read refer to him as you debated a creationist. Most of the articles I read with talk about the science and talk about Bill Nye.
Yeah.
I don't see. I mean, like, the choir that Ham is preaching to doesn't need convincing,
right?
So I feel like the overall impact of that so far, in my opinion, has been positive. More people are talking about science. Bill Nye is everywhere now.
Right.
He's promoting science.
Right. I'm not even commenting on debate. You guys know that I'm in a debate next week. Next Friday here in the Denver area. And hopefully we can put something up on the website about that. But regardless, I'm not 100% convinced that doing a debate is good or bad. I don't know. I'll have to see what happens. But at the very least, science-minded people need to be vocal in defending.
Right. It's more about challenging. Just making a challenge to it. Like you said, throwing a gauntlet down.
Yeah.
So I know people might say you don't want to give any kind of – you don't want to let these people have like a view that is even – put out there, but it is out there.
Yeah.
I mean, like, we have the internet now. It's out there. And if you let people yell out into the void, I mean, like, it's just going to be filled with that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So I'd rather have other people, for science and reason, standing up to say, no, it's this instead.
Yeah, and you don't want to anger people, so it's a constant project of mine, and I think it's something that everybody should be engaged in, and trying to say things in a way that doesn't just automatically trigger someone's anger response
right.
when it's unnecessary. But I think one of the worst things that the skeptic and the nons, that's the right term, right? The people who are not religious, science-minded people who are not religious, I think the worst thing they can do is just not say anything. And that's kind of – I think they do that too often.
Because we're trained to not offend people. Everyone has kind of a – well, to each their own, I guess.
Right. And there are – I think a lot of nons are relativists, so they do have that general attitude of, well, that's not my belief system, but that's your belief system.
Right. And I respect your right to have that belief. And look, right. I understand that, but it's also the fact that some things just might not be true.
Right.
You know, I think – I don't know if Neil said this before, other scientists have, that the truth should not offend you. It just is what it is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in a way, that's not really right, right? Yeah. There are lots of instances where the truth can offend someone. You do your best. But on this issue, since this is an important issue in the United States that affects public policy, it affects science education, it affects a lot of different things, it's worth upsetting a few people.
No, I think it's important, and you know, let's get back in here. Like, instead, you know, after that little,
I'm off my soapbox now.
After that bit of a digression, they're talking about the. It's not even a digression. After talking about the first attempt, really, by someone to say this is how old the Earth is and when it began. Now, instead, we actually bring in something we like to call science and evidence right. into the episode, and this has Neil saying, you know, the age of the Earth, it's written into the rock all right. around us, and we can see it. I love looking at. Bands of rock and stuff, when you could see that kind of geology, I think it's awesome.
It's amazing.
We live in Colorado. You can see it everywhere. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
The red rock and the patterns look beautiful, but when you understand you're like looking at separations of millions of years, I love it.
Processes that have explanations. So you look at them and you think, this is a pattern that people can figure out what's going on here, right? The detectives, basically. Geologists are kind of like pseudo-detectives. I think that one of the things that Neil talks about. Can we just use his first name from now on?
We're on a He says on Star Talk that he's our personal astrophysicist. Yeah, so I think that we're on a first name basis.
Yeah, that's okay. Okay. So Neil Neil talks about how the Earth was formed, and the reason why he's talking about this is because he's building his argument. He's building an argument of why the method that Patterson used to determine the age of the Earth is a valid method,
right.
because the Earth was formed by these rocks. That are out there in space. Some of them are still there. So if you can date one of those, then you can date when the Earth was first formed.
It's pretty sound logic.
Yep.
Yeah, I got to say...
Chalmers, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
He's just listening to us, man. We're just going.
He's just jamming out.
Well, you know... Chalmers, what did you think of Neil separating the Grand Canyon layers? Because I wrote my notes, fucking awesome.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool.
I at first didn't like it. I thought it was a little melodramatic, but then I got over myself.
I feel like it kind of fits his personality to have him show him do something like that.
Yeah.
I
mean, Carl Sagan would never do that, right? Yeah. I can't imagine him on some mountain like acting like he's raising the mountains.
Right. I was like Neil, all he needs is like a staff and he's Moses or something.
This is a space odyssey.
Right.
Gotcha. I just imagined Neil.
Not a voyage.
I just imagined Neil in a turban and a staff.
A space
It actually works, doesn't it?
Right.
Next week he'll be slaying a dragon.
That'd be awesome.
The true story of Jason and the Argonauts.
If he shows up on Game of Thrones, I'm going to lose my shit.
Oh.
They should let him have a cameo in it.
They should.
The court maester.
Oh God, that would be talked about quite a bit.
Well, you talk about the process. You know, scientists were trying like, well, okay, we know that these layers form over time. They knew that,
right.
And they said, okay, well, let's just add up the layers of sediment.
Right.
And this turns out to be hard to do.
Right.
And they kept getting different explanations. I wrote down that geologists tried this and failed. You were getting this date range of the Earth might be 3 million years old to 15 billion years old.
Right.
It was a good attempt. There was some logic behind what they were doing.
Notice how none of these numbers are even close to 6,000.
Right. But still, though, I mean, like, that obviously wasn't the answer either. And that's something that, you know, I like, you know, science doesn't just stop there. We keep going. We reject the old and we bring in the new.
And I got to just say this again. I keep going back to creationist. I apologize. I'm going to stop apologizing, though. Because this is one of the things that I've found difficult when talking to them. They know they will show you an instance of where science has been wrong, or science has changed its mind, or, you know, come up with a different number, or come up with a different answer.
Right.
And that's absolutely valid. But you try to convince them that it's one thing for science to, you know, change its answer from the Earth is several million years old to 4.6 billion years old,
about.
Which is about what it is, what the numbers are now. That's one thing. But when you say that none of those numbers are even remotely close to 6,000, and that you're talking about the difference between a small magnitude of error for specific reasons and a huge magnitude of error for no known reasons, they still don't get it. They just think, well, it can be wrong, so why can't it be my answer?
Well, because look, I just look at it as, look, it's called learning.
Do you understand what I'm talking about, Chalmer?
Yeah, I do. It makes sense.
And it's really frustrating because at that point you realize that they're just looking for any little excuse to validate their beliefs. They're not actually thinking reasonably about what's going on.
Well, look, you see it all the time with how they attack Darwin. Like, well, Darwin said this. I'm like, yeah, he was the first person to discover natural selection and said some other things about evolution that turned out not to be real. But guess what? We have like over 100 years worth of research and stuff since then. So
yeah.
I would be pretty surprised if he knew everything back then. It's impossible probably for him to have.
It's amazing.
Well, the only excuse to say, well, it could be wrong, so why can't it be? My answer would be to sort of disregard an assessment of the evidence.
It's called learning is what I just tell people. Like, it's called learning.
Yeah.
All right. If you believe one thing and then you discover evidence that it's not true and you change your belief, that's not being a flip-flopper. That's not changing the goalposts. That's not. That's called learning.
Yeah. And because of the way science works, of course, any model, which is what theories are, any model of what's going on can be incorrect by the various – it could be wildly incorrect. It's possible.
We see that they're only as useful insofar as they describe or correlate to reality.
Right. But the problem is that because you show that something could be incorrect, that is not an argument for your position.
Right.
Because since human knowledge is incomplete, you really have to provide an argument that not that it's in another view is incorrect, but that yours is better supported.
Right.
You have to actually overcome the amount of
our agnosticism towards an idea.
Right. Right.
Or acceptance. There's no you either justify or you don't know. There's not you're wrong, therefore I'm right.
Right.
It doesn't work.
Right. No, Neil talks about the difficulty in just adding the layers is that we couldn't find rock that was old enough. And this is what you talked about.
Right. And then also that the compression of these layers can be influenced by different kinds of events.
Right.
And so the process is not really linear. You can't really just measure a layer and know how long it took to make it.
Well, this is why we looked out for the asteroids that were out between Mars and Jupiter, the asteroid belt. Because as you were saying, like, you know, those rocks are just failed planets.
Right.
And so they've got to be – they're as old as the stuff that the Earth was originally made of. Right. And it's pristine. It's out there still.
Right.
And it comes here all the time.
Yeah.
And they showed, a meteor crater in Arizona.
Yeah.
You know, and it's all about looking at the, you know, kind of like the iron in the rocks, you know, and you're kind of looking at the radioactive decay. You know, like you're watching as these radioactive elements decay into lead, specifically, to bring it back to lead here.
And I would say that if you're interested in this in more detail, simply go to the Wikipedia page first and go to their page on Age of the Earth and go to the section radiometric dating. Because there they're going to show several different methods that can be used to all come to the same answer. And it's very detailed about the history regarding radiometric dating proper and how it's used to determine the age of the meteorites and other methods that are used, all coming to the same answer.
Well, Chalmer, you're the chemist here. Do you want to kind of give us the elevator version of, like, you know, what are we looking for in the radioactive decay into of one element into another, and how do we use that to determine ages?
The elevator version. I like that saying.
I've never heard the elevator version.
That's really clever. Is it implying that how long it would take to explain something while you're in an elevator?
Yeah, people always say, like, what is your elevator speech of yourself for job interviews? Like, if we had to, like, just a quick version of, like, you know, what are we looking for? Like, what are we talking about when we're talking about – we're trying to measure – why do we want to know how much lead is in these meteorites?
Yeah.
So, yeah, every nuclear active element decays. It spits off portions of its nucleus, and when it does that, it becomes a lighter element.
And is it doing that because it's losing? Is it losing electrons too? Then because of that, or is it just its nucleus?
It's really losing protons.
Okay.
And if it loses electrons, it's just irrelevant to the process.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the important thing is that it's losing nuclear mass.
Right.
Specifically protons, but also neutrons.
Yeah.
Because that nuclei is unstable. So for uranium, it decays into lead when it loses protons and neutrons from its nucleus. The rate at which that happens is very, very constant. It doesn't depend on anything really, whether it's happening 5 miles beneath the surface of the Earth or in an asteroid, the rate that it's occurring is constant. And so you can look at what the starting amount of uranium is compared to the amount of lead that you've obtained. And by looking at the half-life, which is the amount of time that half of the uranium takes to decay to lead, you can work your way backwards mathematically and determine basically the age of the sample. Based Perfect. On the amount of lead to uranium.
Right. And this is essentially what Pat was, you know, Claire Patterson was tasked to do this. He was called into the office. They said, look, we've got some rocks we've already measured, and we want to know how much lead is in these rocks. And if we can do that, we're going to be able to tell the age of the Earth. He told him, like, you're going to be the first person. If you can do this, you'll be the first person to know what the true age of the Earth is. And when you think of that, that kind of knowledge would be just amazing to be the first person to understand that. And I think it was, they said it was Harrison Brown. He was one of the first people who understood that kind of connection between the way the decay rates and into lead. And so Claire Patterson was his grad student, and that's where he started. He started working as a grad student on a project for his, you know, professor essentially was, I want you to go measure the lead here. What were those? I didn't write it down. Chalmers, do you know what are the crystals that they're saying that they know the date of?
They're called zircon. And this is really important because one of the objections to radiometric dating is that, well, you don't actually know how much you started with. So how can you work your way backwards based on what you have now?
I was about to ask you, how did they do that?
With zircon crystals, they incorporate uranium into their crystalline structure, but they do not incorporate lead. They very much favor uranium. So if you have a zircon crystal, you can assume, based on its formation, what your original starting uranium was. You don't have to guess.
So this is, again, Norm, what I love about science, it's all built on things with evidence.
Right.
You know, and that's so important.
Right. And look, the age of the Earth might change. Right? The current age of the Earth.
It's getting older every day.
Crap. It's my understanding that the feeling is that the confidence level of the current known age of the Earth is not 99.99%. There's some admission that they're looking for additional ways to verify this, and you know the dating the Earth directly, as in things on the Earth, which is problematic in lots of different ways, not just the sedimentary, but using radiometric dating of things on the Earth has various problems. But again, the ranges that they get are nowhere near the young Earth creationist ideas. Is this number going to change? Yeah, very well might.
It might fluctuate, but look, whenever someone like a Ken Ham wants to say, like, were you there?
Right.
I kind of feel like you can kind of look at these, zircons and other things and be like, well, kind of. I mean, like, we have these things that were.
Sure.
And we know how they were made. And if you don't think that's how they were made, then you're going to have to refute basically the entire enterprise of chemistry. And good luck. Good luck to you.
Right.
Well, if we go from 4.5 to 5, I feel like we're still a hell of a lot less wrong than 5,000 years.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
One of us is less wrong. As a side here, Pat and his wife, I wrote down, they worked on the Manhattan Project. Kind of cool.
Wow.
Kind of cool. A little tidbit. I was like, look at that. I like his, I like his Professor Brown saying, like, don't worry, Pat, it's going to be easy. Duck soup. No problem. You know, and it turns out it was really hard to measure the lead levels because he kept getting contamination. He didn't understand why. There seemed to be lead everywhere.
I had to watch this episode several times because when I first was seeing it and seeing that he's getting this contamination, I'm thinking, really? Is it our – you're getting contamination that leads to these wildly different results from just the lead in the air? What? It baffled me. And then as the episode went on, I don't know. It took me a couple of times of watching it to put together that it was the two things that are the theme, the major points in the episode, the age of the earth and lead poisoning, those went hand in hand. And he was living in a time period where people were putting lead into the atmosphere.
I liked him saying
that. And so it was everywhere.
Yeah. Duck suit my ass.
Yeah.
He was trying to figure this out. Like, because he doesn't understand why he's being so careful.
Right.
And this is where the idea of the clean room comes in.
Right.
He embarks on, he's like, I've got to just get a very sterile environment. I've got to make it. Mm-hmm. I liked him showing him, like, setting up everything in the building, and then, like, some, like, intern pokes his head. He's like, hey, Mr. Patterson.
Hey,
he's like,
no! Where's the bathroom?
Like, son of a bitch. So, and then, like, they showed eventually, it was like the Get Smart hallway doors, like,
yes,
of like opening
yes.
doors.
Do not enter. Do not enter again.
Right. Yeah. And that's what this is important. These are the kind of measures that scientists take to be right because they don't like being wrong. I mean, that's right. Important.
It can be incredibly frustrating to get good experimental results.
Yeah.
While the forces of air.
Yeah, and this is another point that I'm planning on making in the debate, is that, you know, if you believe in something that contradicts the overwhelming majority of scientists, which, you know, we have with creationism and climate change, as well as other things, like vaccinations, when you contradict what the overwhelming majority of scientists believe, what you are saying is that there are thousands of people who are very sincere, who are, you know, very intelligent and working extra long hours for not that much pay, who, you know, are doing it because they really want to know. And you're saying that they're either idiots or they're in on a conspiracy.
Right.
It just doesn't make any sense.
Like the moon landing conspiracy.
Sure.
Imagine how many people have had to keep their mouth shut for 30, 40 years without letting something slip. We're talking about thousands and thousands and thousands of scientists.
Right.
It's just no way.
And, you know,
they're all in on the same lie.
And, you know, before I, when I was religious, before I, you know, took those two kind of fateful college courses that kind of shook me into sense, I hadn't really met any scientist. One of the things that helped me out quite a bit was meeting an archaeologist because I took his class. And I just was struck by what a sincere guy he was, what an unassuming guy. He was just interested in helping us learn, interested in knowing. And this is one of the things that really smacked some sense into me. I after meeting and talking with this guy in his office hours, I walked away thinking, why would this guy be lying? And he's smarter than me. Why would he believe this kind of stuff if it's just wildly wrong? And that was I think that was probably one of the first things that cracked the veneer of my belief system.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, you know, scientists they're just, I mean, think of this, like he was driven to answer a question: what is the age of the Earth? It wasn't a controversy he was trying to stir up.
Right.
I mean, it was just a simple question.
Yeah, he's not a Satanist who's sacrificing goats on the side and then, hey, let's see how I can mess up society.
And he's talking about not doing it for money. He's not doing it for anything, really. I mean, he's just wanting to know.
Yeah.
Like, there's really nothing. Like, you just say, like, what is there to gain, seemingly, out of this? Nothing. Like, I mean, if you're making a research proposal and you're like, well, we want to try and figure out the age of the Earth. How much does it cost to do this? Probably a lot. What kind of gains are you going to get? Basically nothing. What we'll know of the age of the Earth.
Right.
That's it.
These are for the most people who are just sincerely trying to answer a question and do whatever it takes to answer it. Now, are there scientists who are kind of you know, rude, or scientists who are have big egos and all those bad traits? Sure, scientists are people, but for the most part, when you meet them, they're unassuming truth seekers.
Right. And that's the idea of a scientific consensus is important. It's difficult to get one because everyone is going to go out and test your theory.
Right.
So if you say, this is what I concluded, and they'll say, oh, immediately, just, okay, how did you do that? Let's just back up. How did you do it? So that's what scientists have to tell them. This is what exactly what I did.
Yeah.
And they'll go, I don't know. Okay, we'll see. We'll see.
Right.
And then they run it, and they're like, okay, well, I got the same thing. And someone else is like, I think you guys are both nuts. I'm going to run it. I'm going to check this stuff. I'm going to see.
It's like the difference between, you know, building a go-kart in your garage and building a production car.
Right.
You build a production car, it's going to get scrutinized over and over and over and over again by all kinds of agencies, by the public, by everything. And so you better make sure that everything works right. And if not, well, that's why we have recalls.
Right.
And that makes big deal. That does a fair amount of harm to your company's reputation, all that. Science is a lot like that. When you publish a paper, you are subjecting yourself to a relentless attack of other very smart experts, and everybody is going to, if they can find anything wrong with it, they will.
Right.
One of the things I do like about this episode is that it also presents science in the atmosphere of vested interests. And this is very interesting to me.
Yes.
I'm a scientist in a production, economic-driven company.
Sure.
And
it shows the ugly side of science, right?
It does. And it's extremely important. Vested interest can be kind of a litmus test for good science. Now, it doesn't mean that with vested interest, you can't do good science. I like to think I do pretty good science. But it's something that you should always keep in mind, because we've known about the toxicity of lead for now about, I think, over 100 years.
Longer than that. We've known even ancient Rome when they used it. Here, yeah. Let's get back to the episode here, because they talk about this. I mean, first of all, before we get there, though, Pat succeeds. He makes a room that is clean enough
right.
to take a sample. Chalmers, at your work, do you get to use a mass spectrometer?
We don't have one, no, but I've used one before.
You send stuff out to a lab that has one, right?
Yeah.
There's probably a couple, like literally like two or three of them in the greater Denver area, right?
Yeah, there's some. There's one at Metro.
Right.
Huh.
Yeah, there's some of them.
I mean, that's ultimately what
they're
used.
They're more common than what I'm saying.
Oh, they're very common. Mass spectrometers everywhere.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I love that.
I'm surprised we don't have one.
Yeah. I was just wondering if you did. You told me you got to use the spectroscope and that sort of thing with spectroscopy with your work. So.
Yeah, there's a huge variety of spectroscopes. So, like, I mostly use FTIR and NMR.
I think what I'm thinking of is, isn't there a device that actually counts the molecules?
Mass spectrometer?
Is that a mass spectrometer?
I mean, it kind of like you kind of vaporize the stuff and rip it apart, you know, element by element, and then you count what you've got.
I'm not sure what you mean by count the molecules.
Yeah, I remember the Horizon episode on homeopathy where they wanted to count the actual molecules in the substances that they were using for, into the dilutions. And I guess I'm getting it mixed up. And they were talking about how accurate this machine was and how expensive it was. And I think I'm thinking of that.
Okay. I thought it was cute that the very first person that Pat wants to tell the age of the Earth to is his mom.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like you know, you discover one of the most important discoveries ever in science, and who do you go tell first? Mom.
Yep.
Mom. You know? not everyone was happy with this. Here, we're going to get into some mythology here, because we go back to Rome.
Mm-hmm.
In Rome, they knew that lead was not good, that it caused people to be a little crazy, to act a fool.
Right.
Lead poisoning, not good.
And they still used it.
Right. They used it to build, aqueducts.
The Roman Empire.
Right. They said it may have led to the fall of the Roman Empire. He was talking about in the context of them celebrating a little holiday called Saturnalia. Which, you know, you might be familiar with the war on Saturnalia that happens every year. Fox News covers it. I'm sorry, the war on Christmas, because that's what it became later on. But
and this is, again, they keep kind of having these digs.
Right.
Well, and I just think it's great.
Who knows mythology here, yeah. Okay? Who was Saturn? He's the god of lead.
That's right.
And he ate his children. Not good. But
There's a great Goya painting of Saturn doing that.
Well, you know what this is. I mean, look, the Romans – I'm Greek, so I got to get in my Greek soapbox here. A little mythology lesson here for you. The Romans basically had a bunch of crappy gods. They were jealous. They went to Greece, and Greece had all these awesome gods like Zeus and stuff. They're like, we're just going to take all of them, yeah. But we'll give them our names because otherwise copyright infringement.
Right.
They don't want to get sued by Apple. So basically what they did is they just turned Kronos into Saturn. Kronos, just so you know, is a god. It was a titan. Kronos used to eat his children because of a prophecy that said someday one of your children is going to rise up and kill you. Huh. So he ate all of his children except one day his wife hid a baby, gave him a rock wrapped in cloth to eat instead, and raised this child out in, you know, a cave someplace. And that child grew up to become Zeus and came back and killed his father and made him throw up all of his siblings. All of his siblings, Poseidon, Hades, that's where they all come from.
You can't make this stuff up.
That's where it comes from. Okay. Kronos, Greek mythology. I love Greek mythology. I used to study it when I was a kid. I was fascinated by it.
Why would that god be associated with time, the obvious name?
It changed later.
Yeah.
It was spelled differently even. So it wasn't always associated with time at first.
Huh.
You know, but just like, you know, Saturn, Kronos in Greek mythology had a sickle like that. That's what he used.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Huh.
So, but they said the Romans, they used lead to line aqueducts, which is carrying water.
They used lead to line their pots.
Yeah. So, and they knew
cold water over lead. Yeah, over time, that's going to be bad. But if you're going to heat up that water and concentrate it in a pot, yeah. I mean, forget bad. It. Your lead content bad. Is now quite a bit higher.
Yeah, it's bad news bears to do that. And they were doing this, and then they knew it wasn't good. But why is the same reason we are doing it in the more modern age? It's cheap.
Right.
And that's what it came down to. These are the people who suddenly, these, like, you know, men in black who kind of show up, you know, at Pat's door talking about, are you sure you want to say that lead is bad?
Isn't there a movement to start taking lead out of bullets? Because over the long term,
I think for years they've been trying to do that.
It's introducing too much lead into into our surroundings.
I don't know.
Especially here in the United States where we loves our guns.
Yeah.
Well, what's crazy to me is that this happened in the 60s, right?
Yeah.
The phase out of leaded fuel is really only taken effect in the
Late 90s.
Right.
Late 80s.
It kind of became his life's work later on.
That's
North
America. In Asia, it's 2000 that it really started to take effect.
Sure, yeah.
In South America, the Middle East, we're talking 2005, 2006.
Yeah.
It was cheap, which is weird because for some reason free market capitalism used the cheapest substance even though it was toxic. It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. I don't understand.
Yeah.
I don't mean to sound like a crazy Marxist here, but I hate those arguments that the capitalists make of, well, of course we're going to take the safest measures and use this. No. I'm like, no, you won't.
No. Oh,
if it was still legal to have fucking child labor, they would do it. You know, I mean, that's just the way it is. It's about money.
Shining example of unregulated capitalism.
My notes, I just have dollar signs written everywhere here. I mean, that's what it was about. It was all about the Benjamins, and they were coming for them.
Yeah, you know, if you talk about the invisible hand and how you want to have a safe product, the problem with that is you're assuming that the consumer understands the safety issues.
Exactly.
If they're subtle, and it's the more technologically advanced you get, the more avenues you're going to have for people to not be able to understand the subtleties of the dangers you incur.
Right.
Well, then capitalism is going to be an engine for creating toxins and poisons and hazards.
Well, look, you know, Claire Patterson, his research ironically was funded in part by people who used a lot of lead. That propaganda video they showed of the lead, I thought was amazing. I was like, I couldn't believe that even. I was like, wow.
I think he was largely funded by the oil companies.
He was. When they came to him, they said, look, we need you to kind of back off on the whole lead thing. You've already explored it. We know the age of the earth. Let's not talk about it anymore. And he was like, no, guys, look, I think this might be in the environment everywhere, and it's dangerous. I think I could prove it.
Yeah.
They're like, we don't want you to do that. He's like, I'm going to do it. And the next day, what do you know? His funding got – it just wasn't there anymore.
Gone. Vanished in a day.
I'm sure it was a coincidence. It just wasn't the budget. But and then they hire a guy who's kind of despicable here.
Keogh.
A scientist, yeah. Robert Keogh.
Who does not have a wiki page.
Are you serious?
Touché, yeah.
Good.
Put down on history is an empty name.
He was hired. His sole purpose was to put doubt in the public mind. He said, look, Norm, he used one of those arguments you hear a lot. Lead is a naturally occurring thing. It's not bad. It's natural.
Natural equals good.
Right? And he said, sure, there could be some dangers, but hey, these dangers could be regulated by the industry with self-regulation. No problem.
Self-regulation.
Self-regulation. Industry loves self-regulation. He said there's absolutely no evidence that lead is toxic is one of the things he said.
Yeah, if you Google his name, the first site that comes up is from toxicology.org.
Yep.
Not exactly a glowing legacy.
Oh, God, no. I mean,
this is what Pat embarked on after this, though, was like, I'm going to show that there's lead in the environment. And he started trying to – I loved the episode, got deep. They were showing the lengths that he would go and how careful he was trying to make his observations. And again, Norm, going back to how important science is and the scientific method, I thought it was just great to see that sort of thing, how meticulous he was being with trying to gather his data. And Chalmers, did he start first looking at the lead content in the ocean?
I think he was looking at the polar ice caps.
Well, I know he did that.
Oh, where he looked first? Well, yeah, I think it was the ocean. He was looking at lead at different layers in the ocean.
Because they said it would take normally like hundreds of years, right, for it to mix? Or it should?
Right, because you would, if there were just background sources, if it were a natural source of lead, there should be very little, and you wouldn't expect, you would expect lead to be distributed near the bottom rather than the top.
Right.
But it was the opposite. There was more lead in the surface layers of water than there was below it, and that's weird.
Right. Yeah. And I wrote the man was not happy with Pat's results and kept still trying to work against him. And that's when he went to Antarctica, I think. He was looking for those ice core samples. And they were using that to kind of show that, you know, any level of lead is dangerous, he was able to show. Like, we know that today. But he was kind of showing, you know, there were naturally occurring lower levels of lead than there are in present day. And we were able to use that because the ice is kind of like a nice it's like a nice preservation of, like, the atmospheric contents and that sort of thing. I mean, those ice samples, and they can be thousands of years old. So for people who say, well, how do we know?
Right.
You get this all the time with people who want to deny climate change. Well, how do you know? You're just using ice core samples? Yeah, and those are actually a really good thing to use. And this is just from people who, again, are science illiterate, who don't understand basic science, I think. I mean, I feel like if you understand some basic chemistry, then you could kind of grasp why something like ice core samples would be useful, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, it makes sense to me. And finally, you know, there was a senator. Norm, what do you think of a senator doing something useful? A senator who actually kind of let Pat come and testify, Senator Edmund Muskie.
Politicians, right now, politician is the second most hated profession in the United States. You know what the first is?
Is it lawyer?
Nope.
Is it? I have no idea.
Lobbyist.
Oh, okay.
So
they're all lawyers.
Those are both politically, those are both political positions. Americans right now have the least amount of confidence in politics that we've ever had in our history, I believe.
And they've earned it. They've earned that.
Yeah. But, you know, I think that sometimes it's an attitude of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Because there are certainly in fact, I suspect most politicians are actually sincere.
Yeah.
But most, by maybe like a small percentage, like maybe 51%. There are many that are sincere and trying to do, do the right thing.
But then there are the House of Cards politicians.
Well, yeah. And the problem is even the sincere ones have to spend so much of their time. They'll tell you that they have to spend, you know, almost half their time campaigning.
Wheeling and dealing. Yeah.
Or else they just won't get elected.
So that's not going to change ever until we find a way in this country to get money out of
campaign reform is the absolute, the most important political issue, and people don't seem to know it.
I don't see why people wouldn't want to do it. But.
Well, they do, but the problem is that there are powerful forces that are keeping it where it's at.
It's interesting. I mean, this is one of the areas where, like, a country like Britain is now past us. Like, they don't have money in their campaign. Like, you don't have, like, ads on TV and stuff. You have billboards.
Yeah.
But they're not allowed to put that sort of stuff on there.
Yeah. I mean,
it's better.
And the idea of having unfettered money, uncontrolled money, like we've had in the recent Supreme Court decisions that are equating money with speech, forget it. The game is gone.
All right, so
you got to – I mean, Supreme Court rules on that. I don't know how in the world you get out of that.
By another Supreme Court ruling or an amendment.
Yeah, I mean, that's the only way.
An amendment would do it.
Right. But
– but that's never going to happen.
No. No. So I think we're stuck with it.
Yeah, and, you know, this is kind of where the episode was all drawing to, is that, you know – something like lead in the environment is dangerous. we know this. We could test for it. There are reasons to believe it. And this showed.
And the effects of money on attitudes about it.
That vested interest thing we were talking about. I mean, properly done science doesn't have a vested interest really other than trying to find the truth or answer a question. Whatever that, like, whatever, like Neil said it in the very first episode, we talked about Norm, follow the evidence wherever it leads, whether you like it or not, you know, test ideas, you know, accept the ones that pass the test and reject the ones that don't. This is what science is about. Properly done science won't tolerate something like a vested interest.
Not for long. It can tolerate it for a little while.
Well, we were talking about how long did it take for these regulations against lead to go into place, even though we knew back in the 60s. Pat knew this back in the 60s. And what were you saying? Like in the 90s or in the late 80s is when we finally started to get the lead out?
And this was a big deal. The lead content associated with all of that release, I think they said it dropped the population's IQ level 10 whole points.
Huh?
That when we got rid of lead, violent crime decreased, average IQ went up. It's
really
extreme. Yeah. They've showed this in globally in every country that's phased it out. Violent crime has decreased.
Do you have a link to something about that?
Yeah, I'll post it with the episode.
I'd be interested in seeing that.
Well, I love Neil saying that in the end, nature will not be fooled. You know, when you're studying it, you can have your vested interest, but eventually it falls away.
Yeah.
Because it has to.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to be hopefully getting to a point where climate science is going to be like this, I think.
Well, I mean, at some point it's just going to be undeniable.
It's going to be observationally confirmed.
Yeah, because you'll just continue to measure the average global temperature and, you know, that'll be
higher.
I wanted to close with talking about why is it important to fund science? We talked about it a little earlier, but questions with seemingly little or no monetary value or any kind of expected gain from a monetary standpoint. Yeah. Some people have suggested, well, why can't we just have science be more privately funded? Because we can't. Because you're going to have these vested interests trying to control it. It's difficult to get that out of it.
I don't agree with that attitude, by the way. I wanted to say this earlier, and Chalmers alluded to it, that just because a corporation is behind a science – that doesn't mean that the science is bad. I think that it's intellectually lazy, the follow the money attitude. I think that's intellectually lazy.
I don't think it's that's not the point I'm going for, more as when you're trying to talk to an investor wants a return of something. And a lot of interesting questions in science, though, you say, you know, how much is this going to cost, the test? The answer is going to be a lot.
Sure.
And you tell them, okay, what do I get out of it? Probably nothing.
Well, no. I mean, they're always going to get some sort of recognition for donating, right? That's what is a precedent.
But that's about donating. It, though. I mean, like when you're talking about like what kind. Neil talked about this on Star Talk before.
That's not bad PR.
Yeah, I heard Neil talk about this on Star Talk before. When the problem with like getting research funded a lot of times is like, you know, people say, well, what are we expecting to get out of this? And a lot of times the answer is we don't know yet.
Right.
And that's good for science. Like that's the whole point, is we're trying to find out things we don't know. But whenever you're trying to convince someone that this is a good idea to fund, and they're like, well, how do you know? What are we getting? We're like, well, we don't know yet.
Now, I think you're drifting into a point that I completely agree with, which is that because there is no perceived benefit in a lot of science, no ready-made benefit, that you really, if you're going to have it continue, you've got to fund it collectively.
That's my point.
Right.
I'm not saying anti-business or anti-that. I'm saying that the goal can't be what am I getting out of this?
Right. And, you know, a system of managing money collectively, that's called government.
Yep.
So we need more government funding of research.
And look.
So vote pro NASA. Seriously.
Seriously. Well, we should. Because look, they asked a question. What is the age of the Earth? Now, how many lives have we saved now because we know that lead is poisonous and we've reduced it? That's important.
Well, and I'm not even sure that NASA is the number one.
I'm not talking about NASA in general. I'm just talking about science in general. They are asking a question. They weren't asking. This is something I love about science, these happy discoveries.
Right.
All right. They weren't trying to discover is lead dangerous and toxic.
They were just trying to answer.
That's a question that no one might even think of.
Yeah.
And
this is the NASA effect, right?
Yes.
You do research on one thing. It has branching implications that ends up creating other industries.
Right.
This created an industry to solve the problem of engine knocking without using lead.
Right.
And so you had to have chemists working on that. They were able to solve this. And I think probably this is an interesting question. What if you were going to support monetarily a government organization or branch that would help to fund science? What would be the best organization to fund? Wouldn't it be the NSF, National Science Foundation?
Maybe.
The NIH, National Institute of Health. Yeah, I don't know.
NASA is with regard to space. I'm talking about where can you put your money where it's going to go to the broadest support of science. I think that would be the NSF. I don't know. It's an interesting question, though.
Yeah. I'm not sure.
Yeah, but my point was more of just we gain things from this, and like you're talking about, like the whole a whole new type of industry was created by trying to figure out ways to make engines without lead.
Right.
Industry, agencies people could work at were created to help monitor lead in the environment. Like this does have there is economic value there.
Right.
You know, but it's not something that you could point to and say this is what it's going to do.
Right.
Yeah. You don't know
technology you develop to answer the questions.
Right.
Much greater value.
That's the NASA effect. Now we have fucking Velcro and pens sit right upside down. You're welcome.
Yeah. Maybe here we go with another idea for an episode. Should we have an episode about science funding?
Yeah.
We should.
We should probably bring someone in for this.
I think it's super important. And
I wonder if David Grinspoon would do it.
Well, let's get him back.
He probably would.
This sort of stuff is important, and this is why. Okay. I just thought this was such a beautiful example of a scientist was just trying to figure out the age of the Earth and discovered that lead is everywhere and poisoning people.
Yeah.
I mean, that's so awesome.
It is.
I mean, for people who want to champion reason
and
evidence
and vindication in his lifetime.
Yes, that's
great. That I found was really satisfying as well.
Yeah.
And, they showed a picture of Patterson, and he just struck you as such a kind of down-to-earth kind of guy.
Kind of guy who you'd want to go have to one of those coffee houses and have just a drink with.
Oh, a beer. You know? Yeah, I'd want to have a beer, not a coffee with him. And I think that he was, a little bit of a tough mind, too, which I like. Someone who's going to – you say something, and he thinks it's wrong. He's like, no way, dude. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
He seemed like that kind of straight shooter.
No, I like it. I love this episode for those things like that. Showing that, yes, there are forces inside of science that we have to watch out for.
Yeah.
That's important.
It's a human enterprise. It can be misused, right?
Right, because no one wants to turn the gaze of criticism on yourself.
But here's an important point, though. It's not actually – if you really get down to it, it's not science that is getting misused.
No.
It's science-y things.
Yeah.
Science-ish sounding language.
Like technobabble.
Or a person's scientific credentials
that
is getting that are getting misused. It's not actually science. By definition, if it's actually science, then whether you like it or not, it's getting at an answer that is true or as close to truth as we can come.
Well, that's why a lot of scientists argue that the scientific method, although not implicitly stated, has a sense of a morality built into it.
Sure, sure.
You know, because honesty, integrity, putting it out there, I mean – that is so important. Otherwise, the whole thing fails.
Yeah.
You're not doing proper science if you're not being honest.
And it's not utilitarian. It's not an objective to try to necessarily make things better. It's an answer to – it's an effort to try to answer a question, whether it makes things better or not. But, of course, if you're going to try to make things better, you kind of have to know how things really are, or otherwise you're not actually making them better, right?
Yeah. I mean, in many ways, the scientist is the – modern philosopher when it comes to seeking truth about the material world that we live in.
Answer these general questions. Yeah. Some of them are really big questions.
Right. And I love where it takes us. And so I love seeing the scientific method so beautifully displayed here.
Right.
And the kind of gold that comes from it. Yeah. He turned lead into gold. I mean, I thought it was amazing.
Yeah. Are there still issues with the use of lead? So, for example, I think that lead is
China,
used in
– shit, all those toys that they ship us.
Oh, get this. So the last company legally producing lead is called InnoSpec. They're headquartered in Inglewood, Colorado.
Really?
Jeez.
They are 6 miles from my house.
Well, lead is useful. So
they produce leaded fuel.
They produce leaded fuel?
Yeah, they produce the tetraethyl lead, and they export it to the few countries still using it, like Afghanistan.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
It's taking advantage of countries with out there kind of environmental progress we've made.
What in the world?
In 2010, Innospec, under the trading name Octel, was caught bribing Iraqi and Indonesian officials with millions of dollars in order to continue the use of tetraethyl lead. In 2010.
Vested interests. Look.
Isn't that fucking crazy?
It is.
That is
crazy. It blows my mind.
And they're down the goddamn street.
That sucks.
Should
we get the black outfits and the hoods and go out, you know, some day at, you know, like 2 o'clock in the morning and
let's get anonymous
mess their shit up.
All right.
Yeah. No. Don't do that.
Tell them to get the lead out. You know, people complain about the cost. Well, the cost that the EPA puts on businesses, Norm.
Chalmers seeing lawsuits.
Yeah, do not take that advice, for the love of God.
I'm kidding.
The Mile High Sanity Project does not endorse Norm's phone.
You guys are hilarious.
No, people complain about the cost that the EPA imposes on business and stuff in America, but it's really I took an environmental law class. It's undeniable how much cleaner our environments have gotten since they started doing that basically back around the 60s.
Sure.
And it's staying clean. And you can look at countries like China. China may never – have you seen cities like Beijing may never be clean again?
Sure.
Okay, they just might never be able to clean the air again. They just might not.
Yeah,
it's really bad in China.
And it matters. And these less developed countries who are kind of going through their own mini industrial revolutions and they don't know about the reason why you should have these regulations.
Sure.
I mean, I understand them saying like, well, look, it's one thing for you in a more advanced, you know, country to say, well, you shouldn't do this, but we need to do it. And I'm like, you know, you're going to eventually have the same problems we did, and you can avoid those.
Yeah.
And it's important.
And to say that our environmental situation is better than it was before, all while our population is increasing not a rate like some of the poor countries, but at a rate that is fairly high for a developed country, that's saying something.
Yes.
You got more and more people using resources, using technology, and yet the air and water and soil and those things are getting cleaner. That is a real testament to the power of ultimately scientific discovery and using it toward good.
Well, sometimes it just might, you know, we talk about following the evidence wherever it may lead. It might lead you to a conclusion that's not the most profitable.
Yeah.
And that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
You know, lead was cheap to make.
But of course, if the public is informed, your health is a tradable commodity.
Yeah.
Therefore, that establishes an inherent worth to it, and therefore you have industries that can make money from that. And that's exactly what we've seen, right, with the industries that took the lead out of the gasoline and other industries that are involved in clean energy, things like that. That the public supports that enough because they recognize that we don't want to be shooting ourselves in the foot.
Right.
So
it's important. I love the series. This is getting better.
Yep.
And better. So
next episode is awesome as well.
We'll be back, folks. It's good. Chalmer, any closing thoughts?
I found the perfect picture for this episode.
Good.
It is the a painting from 1555 called The Mutilation of Uranus by Saturn.
Well, there you go.
Got to be careful how you say that.
Uranus.
Indeed.
Also, got to be careful how you Google it.
Indeed. Yeah. If you search that, put in the whole thing.
Yes. Make sure it's one word.
Do the proper Boolean search. Otherwise, hilarious things will happen to your browser. Hilarious.
But it's been seen, cannot be unseen.
Right. All right, everyone. Well, thanks for listening. Always, please, think responsibly and get the lead out. We'll be right back.